Dan, my name is Dan Erlander, and you are here to share a book review, or a booklet review, I should say, of By Faith Alone, a Lutheran Looks at the Bomb. So if you're here for volcanoes, that's in the next, this is the bomb, that's volcanoes. Okay. You'll notice I just asked the sign for a bomb. You can watch it now. There. Okay. It's just a very, explosion. Like to begin, or else my agenda for this hour would be to spend about 35 minutes just with a review, and during that review, if you want to break in with questions, fine, but I'll try to break so we have at least like 20 minutes then for discussion and your response to the booklet and the ideas in the booklet at the end. And then we don't have to worry about discussion ending here because the forum tonight will continue the same subject. So if it raises questions, we can continue at 9 o'clock. I'm going to begin with a story, and I think I was inspired by last night's Vespers, that I think a story can maybe pull things together. And I'm going to tell this story. It's a story of an actual event that happened in history. And I'd like to tell the story and then at the end really not make any comments on the story, just let the story stand. And then if you would keep the story kind of in the back of your mind while the book is being reviewed and also in the back of your mind in the forum tonight, the more I tell this story to myself, the more I feel it is profound in what it means to us. It's a story of a hero, and the hero's name is Telemachus. Has anybody heard of Telemachus? Good. Two. Telemachus was a monk who lived about the year 400 in the Roman Empire, Asia Minor, what is today Western Turkey. We're told that he was small of stature, and Telemachus was deeply concerned about something that was still going on in the Roman Empire, even if it was years now after Christianity had been accepted as the state religion of the Roman Empire. And that is, the citizens still flocked to the amphitheaters to watch the gladiator battles, including the Christian emperor, Honorius, who sponsored the gladiator battles. And so many, many, many of the people who went to watch the gladiators kill each other, or one kill one, were people who at least nominally professed to be Christians. Telemachus knew that he had to do something about this because of his obedience and his faithfulness to Christ. But what could he do against an entire empire and against a practice that was just ingrained into the life of the Roman Empire for centuries? Well, he didn't know what he would do, but he decided to go to Rome. So across the water to Rome, got there about the time one of the gladiator battles would be beginning in what we know today as the Colosseum. He joined the crowds on the way, and he had a ticket and had a seat, and here he was surrounded by the thousands and thousands of people who were waiting with great excitement as soon two slaves would meet one another and one would kill the other to the amusement of the crowds. Telemachus knew this was so far from the spirit of Christ and still did not know what he would do. But when, I have to apologize, I added that it's possible he did know what he was going to do. I don't know why I added that. That's not part of the story. When you're a storyteller, you try to make it more dramatic, and when you're dealing with history, one should try not to throw in things like that. He either did or he didn't know what he was going to do. But when the gladiators came out on the field of the amphitheater, this little monk, Telemachus, ran down, holding a cross in his hand, jumped over onto the field, ran to the two gladiators, and stepped in between them, held the cross up, and cried out, "In the name of our master, stop." And the two gladiators were so taken or overcome by this little monk between them that they just stopped and just looked at him and looked at each other. Now the crowd, whose excitement had been building up for this battle, all of a sudden realized that what they had paid money for, what they had come for, their entertainment had now been spoiled, and they turned into a very mad mob psychology, ran down or rushed down, taking stones, sticks, anything they could find, and they beat Telemachus to death. And there was the two gladiators who had stopped fighting, and now the body of the little monk with the cross still in his hand. And all of a sudden there was a hush that came over the crowds as they realized what they had done. The emperor, Honorius, sensing the mood of the crowds, they saw him quietly walk out of the amphitheater. And then in complete silence, the thousands of people just slowly walked out of the Colosseum. Honorius went and he issued an imperial edict stopping for all time throughout the entire Roman Empire any future gladiator battles. And never again was there a battle of gladiators. And this was the year 404 AD. I'd like to share a little of the background of my involvement in the subject that led to putting this little booklet together called By Faith Alone. I think the background of how it came together was some of the studies I've done, and some of you maybe have been involved in some of these studies. I guess my three favorite things to study and teach are the Book of Revelation, third century baptism, and the Book of Ephesians. And they have something in common that have very profoundly influenced me in the way I think and the way I understand the Christian faith. The Book of Revelation, the theme of the book is this passionate appeal through these symbolic pictures and words, this appeal to the Christians to not offer incense to Caesar, and therefore to not worship the emperor, and therefore to not worship everything the empire represents. It is a book crying to Christians to say no. Okay, this a similar theme in third century baptism. If you were a convert in the third century, this was before the peace of the church, or just before Constantine, part of your last hours before your baptism was to be with the Christian community. Now, by the way, this was after days and days and days during Lent of exorcism. And you had exorcists who each day prayed that evil would leave you and you would be free from the clutches of evil. They had a sense that a person coming into the church, into the faith, was just in the clutches, the tight clutches of evil, evil powers, evil principalities. And your daily exorcism before your baptism was kind of a pulling away of one little finger of the clutch and another. But it was not till you went into the waters of baptism that finally you were free from the powers of evil. And to symbolize that and to make that profoundly effective in your life, just before your baptism, you would be asked to cry out a resounding no against the powers of evil. you would also be asked to spit at the West. The West being the place that gobbles up the sun, gobbles up the light, the place of evil. You would spit at the West to show your total renunciation of the ways and the powers of evil. Okay, then the book of Ephesians. The purpose of the church in the book of Ephesians is to witness to the principalities and powers, the evil powers of this world, by living another way of life. So it's again a theme of the church lives in the context of not only what the church says yes to, and that was in the baptism too, you say yes to Jesus Christ, but you said yes to Jesus Christ in the context of what you said no to. And that was the powers of evil. And it's with that background now that would enter into the study of the nuclear arms race. Now, how I got involved in this this area very specifically, it was somewhat of a slow process, I think, for me. One was several years ago reading an article by Jim Wallace about slavery in the 1900s, and he showed how most Christian ministers did nothing, said nothing about slavery, and showed how probably very few say anything about what is the great moral issue of our day, the nuclear arms race. And I realized I'd never mentioned it in a sermon, in a class, or in a conversation, or in pastoral counseling, or anything. Then, sometime later, we were planning a conference in Albuquerque, where I moved from to Holden, on the issue of nuclear disarmament. And we had a planning group that met monthly for a year of about 40 people from all different kinds of religious traditions and backgrounds. And each time a person was asked to give a 10-minute speech on peacemaking from my tradition. You know, and the Mennonite gave a great speech. The Roman Catholic had all kinds of papal encyclicals. The Quaker gave a wonderful speech. I was asked to give the Lutheran background in peacemaking. And I said, well, I said, after I finish in 10 seconds, what do I do with the rest of the time? You know, we don't have a strong tradition in peacemaking, so I started to move in then to a Lutheran teaching with the question, can I approach the nuclear arms race from the standpoint of the teaching of my own church, the confessions of my own church that I embraced when I was ordained? Then when I was coming up to Holden, my brother, who's a pastor in Colorado, asked me to come to lead a workshop on the arms race for the Nebraska and Rocky Mountain Synods of the LCA for their social ministry people. I turned him down three times because don't know that much about it, and he wanted me to come to Colorado for a visit. So he kept inviting me until I said yes. And so when I came here to Holden to work on the Resource Center, since my task was resources, I said, well, I'll take 7 weeks to work on this issue. And it was a tremendous, not only a learning experience, but a faith experience and a spiritual experience to spend every day for almost 7 weeks just looking into one issue and its meaning for our faith. And out of that came a booklet I used at that conference, and then came back and reworked it, and that's the result of that, is this little booklet called By Faith Alone, A Lutheran Looks at the Bomb. And I meant this by A Lutheran Looks at a Bomb, I mean me, who is a pastor who has promised to teach the Lutheran from the standpoint of the Lutheran confessions. Now, I'm going to just briefly show the book has kind of a line of argument, and I want to show what that line of argument is in the next 15 or 20 minutes, and then let you respond to that. And if you have a book, you're welcome to follow. If you don't, I'll tell you what the pictures are. Anyway, okay, you ready? Or is there anything from what I've said so far anybody wants to respond before we move on.
Okay.
On the inside cover, or it says this is a theology book, and it's very important to me, and it'd be very important to communicate to any church group that would study this booklet, that to move into this booklet means a real commitment to study theology. In other words, to study our understanding of God in relation to this issue. Because too often when we discuss the arms race, we discuss two things. One, we discuss military strategy. Jesus never called his church to gather together to discuss and study and argue military strategy. I challenge you to find that any place in the New Testament. But we do that usually when we get together to discuss this issue. Or we discuss and argue who's ahead in the arms race, we or the Soviets. You know, and we get arguments back and forth. And in Lutheran teaching, if Martin Luther were here when we would do this, he would know exactly what we were doing, because he knew exactly what people were doing in his day, doing the same thing with different issues. It's called avoiding the living word. Or it's called, as in our text last Sunday, Adam and Eve hiding behind trees. And when God says, "Where are you?" you duck behind the tree of political arguments or military strategy or politics or whatever. And if there's one a task and encouragement in going into this book, that in the feeble way of putting down words and pictures, the prayer is that in entering the pages of this book, that our hearts will be open to the living word of God. Now, then turning to page one, the concern now out of which this book flows, and the title is By Faith Alone, is this rather, you might call it a schizophrenic way of approaching life in the Lutheran Church. And that is, when it comes to our personal salvation, we preach and we believe and we're secure in the fact that our personal salvation or our standing before God is totally a gift of God's grace and the work of the power of God that we receive only by faith, which also is a gift and a result of the power of God in our lives. And we say and we confess and we rejoice and we affirm and we celebrate, we do nothing. Okay. Then when we move as Lutheran people to the way history will move, this is in the context of saying we believe in a biblical faith that says God or Yahweh is the Lord of history, then we turn it around and say, but it comes to the movement of history, it is by our works alone. And over we affirm that God is powerless in the movement of history, and it's up to us. And nowhere is this a belief more evident than in the Lutheran part in our whole nation's belief that somehow the way this world moves depends on how much power of military might and ammunition we have as a nation. We confess it is by us alone. So that now is a background and it's a real problem for me as a Lutheran. But I confess one thing when it comes to my personal faith, and I confess another thing when it comes to history. Does the point make sense? Do you see? I need some head nods or something. Not that you agree with me at this point, but is it clear what I'm saying? I got enough nods. Now, from that point, I'll just look very briefly at the nuclear arms race. on page 2. The first paragraph just tried to put in a little paragraph what the possibility of nuclear destruction means. You know, and others have done that in a much more powerful way, especially like the Physicians for Social Responsibility. But just to say, if restraint is used, which many say would be impossible, nuclear war will bring the instant mass death or murder of millions, death by burn for millions more, slower death for more, then on and on to the psychological damage and all of the social damage, and the possibility of total nuclear war, meaning the possible destruction of the whole ecosystem of this earth and of human life. Yet in contrast to that, how our government leaders, I don't think they're talking about this anymore, or not as loudly, just talking about nuclear warfare as one more additional tool in a long line of military history. Now, the real trembling that I have as a Lutheran is that every Sunday we confess that we are in bondage to sin. And then we are so either numb or callous to the fact that the power to destroy everything that God has created here on this earth is in the hands of the people that we say are in bondage to sin. That's us. That's why at the bottom of 2, all we can really do is kneel, get down and kneel, cry out, Lord, have mercy upon us. At our recent synod meeting, and this was probably true at all synod and district meetings, the nuclear arms race is discussed and argued about and resolutions are passed. And I was sitting there, I was so disturbed how this issue almost comes up on the floor like another political issue, with the liberals tending to be on one side and the conservatives on the other. And I almost want to stand up on the floor of synod and take out pictures of everybody's children, you know, and just wave them and say, these are the people we're talking about, pictures of yourselves or your loved ones. We're talking about the end of everything that's precious. Well, page 3, I've tried to chart out where the nuclear arms race has gone since 1942. And I found it's important to understand what Richard Barnett has called the three arms races. The first arms race, the second is really the arms race of deterrence, and how we are just at this moment, or in these years, moving into what could be called the third arms race, where it is no longer deterrence, I'll hit you if you hit me, but it's first strike. First, we are developing the weapons of first strike. Now the Soviets are in the process of following, as you'll notice in they have followed in about every step. Now it moves to, I'll hit you if I think you're going to hit me because you thought I was going to hit you. And just by saying that, you get a sense of how much more dangerous and threatening the arms race is moving as it moves into this new phase from the phase of deterrence. And then on page 4 is the just talking about the typical reaction is one of really numbness. And if we had time here, I'd have you break up into little groups of 4 and just talk about how have you personally responded to the nuclear arms race. I was out this last weekend to the first parish I served near Chicago for an anniversary, and people asked me what I was doing, and I enjoyed somewhat, it's probably my humor, enjoyed saying, well, I just wrote a little booklet on the bomb. And most people responded almost kind of proud that they don't think about it. You know, that they're kind of secure enough not to really think about it. Part of the page 4 is to help people to think about really feeling. We can feel present disasters, we can feel past disasters, but it's so hard for us to feel future disasters. If everyone here could go to Hiroshima and go through the museum, I think everything would be different for us. Now, the next page, on page 5, I move from the nuclear arms race, and now for several pages won't even talk about it, but instead have just thrown here in the middle a little Lutheran catechism on the meaning of sin and evil. And we are part of the American church that, as Lee Griffin said last week, we preach a radical gospel against a background of a pastel evil. Isn't that something? A radical gospel against the background of a pastel evil. And we proclaim this wonderful liberation in Christ, but then we're timid about telling anybody what we might be liberated from. Okay, that's what we move into. But now first, the human dilemma in our Lutheran understanding is not that we break rules. We've heard this many times, but the opposite, or I'll back up a minute, our problem is not that we break rules, but we fail to trust the only one that is worthy of our ultimate trust and the only one who is finally trustworthy, and that is God. Luther's life was spent preaching, "Let God be God." One of the great Luther theology books, Philip Watson, is that title, "Let God be God." The human dilemma is that we choose to make gods out of things that are not worthy of being God. And top of page 6, when one studies this book, I would suggest nobody look at page 6 until you've done this. Just list some of the things that we turn into gods. And we say, "I will worship that, and I will fall down before that, and that will give me my worth and my meaning and my salvation." You know, and we wouldn't put it in that religious of language. We kind of cover that up. But I think all pastors or others who have been close to people who are dying, I could ask you, have you ever been with a person on the deathbed who says, "Money is wonderful," and then smiles and dies? No. Because at death we face reality. Why then do we spend year after year even forsaking family life, and the joy of prayer and even fun and recreation to bow before what, when death comes, it fails us? That's the definition of a false god. It's a god that is finally untrustworthy, or that finally fails. And on that page are some examples. Then on page 7, also the understanding, not only we as individuals have false gods, the bottom of 6 is important to me. It's just examples as I kind of went through my ministry and my counseling, and without pointing out specific names and peoples, but just general examples. And the picture there is very close to me, or to any pastor, as one has tried to help and work through and talk through someone whose false god has failed and now his life has fallen apart. Okay, the next page, how not only individuals choose false gods that let them down, societies do. Groups of people, we call these our isms. They're the racisms and nationalisms and sexisms and materialisms. And it's against the background of these idolatries that the liberating the word of the gospel comes. And that's the word coming out of the scripture here on page 7, where God simply cries through his scripture, "Trust me. Trust me and trust me alone." And then it's the Spirit that empowers us to respond to this call of God to trust. And then the freedom. And that freedom is on page 8, that Christ now is all. Christ is everything. Christ is life. Christ is God. Christ is my life. Christ is with me in life. Christ is my Lord in my death. And Christ never forsakes me. And this is freedom to cling to Christ and to Christ alone. And probably in our Lutheran tradition, we have no more radical word than in the fourth stanza of A Mighty Fortress Is Our God, where we confess as we stand up, and you know, we always stand to sing that hymn. I don't know where that started, but we stand because the confession of this hymn is so important to us as Lutherans. And look what we say in that fourth stanza. Powers of evil can take my house away. They can take all of my fame and my status away. They can take my wife or your husband away, loved ones, child, and even wrench my life away, and they have won nothing. The kingdom remains. The kingdom is ours forever. You know, not until you understand the radical faith of our Lutheran confession that Christ is all, and if we lose everything, we lose nothing, do you understand the freedom of the gospel. And if you think back now, connect this to a truly free person, the little monk Telemachus. Now on page 9, one of the wonderful things about being a Lutheran is you don't have to be afraid of the dark. Was anybody here afraid of the dark as a child? I used to have to go out to the garage, and it was in Illinois, and that, you know, how the bugs sound in Illinois. It was about 60 feet to the garage. And I would run like this because I was weaving between lions and tigers and snakes. You know, and I'd always make it, but I was very frightened. And fear of the dark, and in a much deeper meaning, that's an example, but a much deeper meaning, that when I believe that the grace of God forgives all, there's nothing about my life or my past or my present involvements that I have to be afraid. None will condemn me. For only Christ is my judge, and Christ says, I forgive you. We don't have to be afraid, and that's why now we as Lutherans can enter in to what I think is the darkest realm of our existence as Christians in the American state, and that is this mad movement and a mad trust in military weapons, and especially nuclear military weapons. Now we got to back up before we do that and do some biblical work that biblical scholars have done with the Pauline understanding of principalities and powers. Most of us who went to seminary in the 60s or so crossed off what the Bible said about the devil and Satan and demons as kind of a primitive spookism, that we sophisticated people no longer accept, and we feel, we kind of chuckle at those people who still believe that there were spooks floating around, and we have it reserved for one night of the year, and that's always the night of Reformation Day. Halloween, if you didn't know what. Our one time to recognize evil powers in this world. And how scholarship of the Bible now has helped us see that when Paul was talking about the spiritual forces in the air, he was talking about something very, very real. And to get at this, got to hurry here. To get at this, we have to start with our Lutheran understanding of the orders of creation. As Lutherans, we say that the structures of creation, like family and government and economic systems, are all gifts of God. They're given to us to just make human life possible. I mean, imagine waking up some morning and there was no economic system, no government, no family. There would not be human life as we know it. And we forget that sometimes when we talk about the arms race, that if you exist in your bomb shelter, and come out of that shelter, the structures of life are gone. We usually don't think of that. Jonathan Schell talks about that rather extensively in The Fate of the Earth. But as Lutherans, we say, just as an individual human being has fallen, so structures fall. And as Luther said, to fall is to be turned in. And so a structure that is created by God to serve human life, to give human life that way of living in a structure and existing with organization, you might say, this structure, instead of giving, turns itself around and becomes demonic in that it says, I am God. And you human beings that I am created to serve will now serve me. Now we can look at examples, and it helps to look at very specific examples and very exaggerated examples in history. One of them would be the Nazi regime. Another would be the economic system of slavery. And another recent would be the Jim Jones People's Temple. All one an economic structure, one a religious structure, one a government structure, all that became demonic and turned and said, you will serve me rather than my serving the people. And these systems then enslave. And I think you got an example of this if you watch the Holocaust on TV, how people who were involved in turning on the gas in the gas chambers were really victims of powerful structures that enslaved them. Now, what my argument now is that the arms race is, as Lutherans in the Augsburg Confession, we would say that the military is one of the legitimate government services for the protection of citizens. But then we raise the question now, has this legitimate system gone out of control and become a demonic power, as Paul would say, the powers in the air? And so I take two test questions now to bring to the structure of the arms race. Examples of past fallen or demonic structures. One, the system demands a tremendous sacrifice, the first fruits. The system demands almost, you'd say, a worship. And then secondly, does the system deliver what it promises? And when we look back at the past, Nazism demanded total obedience and finally totally failed to give what it promised. Now on the next 11 and 12, the picture says it more than the words. That if there ever is an example in human history of a people that have lined up before an idol to throw almost everything into it, it's our military arms and nuclear buildup. I'm running out of time, but sometime read the apocryphal ending of the book of Daniel, where Daniel has the argument with the king over whether or not a god is real or not, and the god is a statue, Baal. And the king worships the statue every day, and the way the king knows that this statue is truly God is this. He says to Daniel, can you not see how much he eats and drinks every day? That is the proof. Now, Daniel knows that the priests and their family have a trap door under the statue, and every night they open the trap door, get all the food, feed their families, drink all the liquor that he's put on this table for the idol, close the trap door, and the king comes the next morning and says, "Ah, this is God." Well, think about how that fits. How do we sacrifice to this idol? And I started with our money. If the Reagan program, of a military program, goes through, it's going to mean over $10,000 per taxpayer through 1986. Then the tragedy, and I couldn't read more and more about this without tears. What we could do with just 17% of our military budget in the world, 17%. This means $32 billion. And the estimated cost overrun for the Reagan military program is between $300 and $750 billion. So we're talking about $32 billion to feed everybody in the world that's hungry, to vaccinate every child in the world, to build schools and provide teachers for everybody in the world that does not have a decent education, to vaccinate all the children of the world, to provide water, health services, family planning, helping the small farmers throughout the entire world, 13%. And close your eyes, pray about that, think about that, that's 13%. Then the others I just suggested, the other ways, even an economic recovery that we want so desperately, we feed to this God. I don't know that much about economics, but I know that shoveling money into a hole would cause inflation. Am I right if you're in economics? Okay. And then the final is the spiritual loss in our nation. When we as a nation have committed ourselves to the ultimate violence, now how much does this contribute to the whole way of life of violence? Okay, that's the first question. The second question is this: does the arms race deliver what it promises? And then I've tried to show, and you might have to read more resources on this, how every dollar that we put into the arms race, we're farther away from what the arms race promises, and that is security. And the thought on that is, if there were a nuclear war, the security that is promised would only be given to those flying in a far-off command airplane, a deep tunnel, or if you're a missile, surrounded by other protective missiles. All of us who believe the lie would either burn or suffer generations of terrible disease. All of us who believe the lie and shoveled millions and millions and millions of dollars into the mouth of a hungry, hungry God. And then the next page raises the question, well, what if maybe if we give enough money, we'll finally close the window of vulnerability? And then the reminder of how, as Lutherans, we say the human being will do anything to try to escape the truth, anything to try to escape the reality of our illusions. And if we were totally invulnerable to Russian missiles, we would still have the millions of hungry people in the world. And Mark Hatfield says that's much more threatening than all the bombs that have been made. Now, I raise then on the next page a third question. Another characteristic of past demonic systems is they always need an enemy. In order to get the slavery of the people, have an enemy that then promised protection from the enemy. You know, the Nazis had the Jews, the people's temple head, the evil world, whatever that was. And this is where the Soviet Union, while we admit it's a tremendous power in the world, how that becomes one, as you see the picture on page 15, one of maybe 100 ways that feed this machine that continues and continues and continues. Now the rest of the book I'm not going to discuss that thoroughly because it would take hours. But I move from there sensing the darkness of this involvement. Now one question that's often raised, okay, you've blasted us who are Americans, what about the Soviets? You know, and again, our Lutheran teaching clearly informs us that when we talk about sin, I talk about my sin and not yours, and we talk about our sin and not theirs. It's very clear in our Lutheran teaching. That's why I've chosen to really concentrate on our involvement. Okay, then on page 16, I move into a mystical encounter with Jesus. And if you don't know it, that's very Lutheran. Luther was a mystic. The direct experience with Jesus. And I take all of my questions about the nuclear arms race to Jesus as I understand Jesus and have a talk. And I've tried in this part just to say what my talk with Jesus is about. Then on page, the final part of my talk with Jesus is my realization I can't do anything about the nuclear arms race. And then comes that wonderful word of grace that Jesus says, I'll do it. But you come along and help me. Okay. Now then the last part is the testing of this mystical experience. Because our Lutheran tradition says that we never stop with our experience with Jesus. It has to be tested by Christ and the Christ we know in Scripture, all of Scripture, and the life of the Church. So I take my experience and then test it with what I tried is an understanding of what the Bible says about war and peace, about violence and nonviolence. And then ending with the life of the church and especially the Lutheran church and how our tradition informs us with a justifiable war tradition. Then close the book by testing our involvement in nuclear arms with the principles of the justifiable war, concluding that there can be no justifiable use of nuclear arms. Therefore, as Lutheran Christians, we're called to do what the back cover says, encourages us to do, join Martin Luther in throwing the inkwell at the powers of evil as they are locked into this demonic system and simply say no. And then the final page is then when we've said no, as the early Christians did in baptism, where do we turn? But we turn to embrace Christ. Christ in prayer, Christ in worship, Christ in the neighbor, Christ in the Christian community, Christ in the neighbor. And there we live by faith alone. And come back to the title of the booklet. Well, that's fast. I went over my promise time. I got wound up. We have 10 minutes, so I sure invite your responses and your struggles. I mean, I've poured out to you what's been many weeks of struggle that I fought with a lot of what I said myself, within myself. So don't be embarrassed if you're right now saying kind of a big BS. I've said that many times, you know, and I still in my mind fight back and forth, so don't be embarrassed.
Okay. Yeah, go. You said that there's nothing we can do, and then you said that Christ said, I will do it if you'll come and help me. And then you talked about the tremendous amounts of money that go into the system, and then we pay about $10,000 in the next 4 years. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. I understand it.
Okay. That's true. Then what is your feeling about Bishop Hunthausen's response to withhold his taxes that would go into military spending. And is that an option for Lutherans? Is that something that we should discuss and take a very serious look at?
Yeah, I can, you know, speak from what, from when I read Bishop Huntenhausen's speech, it hit me, all I can say, it hit me right where it hurts, because I have spent hours lecturing on the Book of Revelation on giving the pinch of incense to Caesar, how the first century Christians were asked to give the pinch of incense to Caesar and say, Caesar is Lord. And in that speech, he said that our tax money to the nuclear arms race is our pinch of incense. And it just, you know, and, you know, this is a personal thing, and I can only believe that personally for myself. You know, this is not church doctrine. We might someday become a confessing church, like in Germany, or it might be. And so, you know, I would be very against ever laying down a law to other people, you must withhold taxes, but it is an option for Lutherans to be faithful. Is that, you're wondering if it could fit within the Lutheran?
Well, obviously it can't be a law, yeah. But it seems to me that I'm wondering if we're skirting it and saying, well, Huntenhausen's a little bit crazy and just have to write him off, rather than take what he says seriously and just, if nothing else, to have people in our Lutheran churches say, is this one thing that we could do? We constantly talk about, there's nothing I could do. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if that's an option.
Yeah. I hope it's clear that when I said Jesus says I can do nothing, it means that I'm pulled into God's movement to stop the arms race rather than doing it myself. Yeah, yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I hear a voice.
It says the last page, look, throwing the inkwell at the devil. That's so tied up with our writing a check to IRS, it seems to be a beautiful symbol. I mean, a minute from now, you just pick up the inkwell and say, part of my taxes, but I'm not going to pay. Yeah, I think that's
great. Yeah, it's, how do you make what Luther did contemporary? You know, I think the ink spot's still on the wall at the castle here in the tent.
Presumably the bishop's threat is symbolic because his income is insufficient to get him in trouble with the IRS.
No, he withheld $160 and he's already heard from him. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Well, that may be insignificant, but he did withhold $160.
I would be more impressed if someone of substantial means did it.
There's lots of people who are doing it.
And they're not being pressed?
Sure they're being pressed.
Oh, good.
There's Jack. You want to be the last one. We'll invite you to the forum if you feel like we aren't quite finished here. And then, Jack, you say what you're, and then we'll all run to Vesper Seder Fest.
Well, there are people that are doing things with whom we can be in solidarity, such as John Nelson in Seattle, people like that, not attempting to lay a trip on people. But he does need support, and that's one way that you can get your feet wet, the way that Mark was talking about. I thought that was a great question, Mark. You're good to point.
Okay, thank you. Let's go worship now.